Members, we're going to call the State Government Finance Committee meeting to order. Before we get into the heart of today's issue, we do have two new pages with us today. We don't know if they're going to be with us for the long term, but I'm sure you'll probably see them in other committee hearing rooms as well. So I could have you guys come up to the testifiers table and introduce yourself, and hopefully we'll cross paths more than once. So if you can just give your name and a little bit about your background.
I'm Barb Smith, and I'm got a cold, so I'll try not to talk too close to the mic. My background is I live in Minnesota. That's it, but I'm so happy to be here and see this process. It's amazing to me, and I love it. So
that's great.
Hope to see you all.
As long as you're not up from Iowa, we're all good.
My name is Kevin Petrie. I'm also from Minnesota. I just love the Minnesota politics.
Very good. Well, welcome, guys. All right, with that, members, if you could please take note, in your committee folder are the minutes. Hopefully you've had a chance to read through them. And Representative Howe, what do you think about those minutes?
Move to accept.
Okay. All those in favor accepting the minutes from January 13, 2015, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. And any opposition? All right, we're good to go. The minutes are for January 13, 2015 are approved. And with that, members, I'm going to hand over the chair to Vice Chair Howe. I didn't tell him this, so we're going to have him chair the committee today. We've got a couple of guests. So.
Well, today on the on the agenda, we have our legislative auditor Jim Nobles is going to give us an update or a review of the commission and Auditor Jim Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is Cecile Perkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division. I really appreciate this opportunity to be with you. I feel a real kinship with this committee in particular. I used to sit in the chair that Mark Shepard occupies. I started my career on the other side of the table and was there for 6 years. I think I sort of pretended to be Mark Shepard until they found the real one who is much better at his job than I was. But anyway, what I saw in that chair is that legislative oversight is very important, that it's part of your primary responsibility to control the purse strings, the money that is appropriated. And the other piece of that action that has to be taken is follow-up and oversight. And the reason I feel kinship with that is that's why the Office of the Legislative Auditor was created in 1972, to extend legislative oversight and accountability deeper into the bureaucracy and come back to you with information about how that money is being spent. And so I want to give you just a really quick overview of the office, who we are, what we do, how we do it, and then I'm going to talk a bit about our budget proposal. So, again, the Office of the Legislative Auditor was created in 1973 as a very specific act on the part of the legislature to strengthen accountability and legislative oversight. Now, many people wonder, well, what was happening before 1973? We had a state auditor, elected official. Well, interestingly, historically, the state auditor did not audit the agencies of state government. The auditor was more or less a controller, signed warrants within the executive branch. The auditor of state government and local government prior to 1973 was the public examiner. And the public examiner was appointed by the governor and had audit jurisdiction over everything. And there was a feeling at that time in the legislature and by a blue ribbon panel that made a recommendation that that did not provide adequate independence. And that really the audit function ought to be in the legislative branch, again, as an extension of legislative oversight. And so that's why in 1973 this office was created. In order to ensure a level of independence for the office, the legislature established the position of the legislative auditor as an appointed position from the Legislative Audit Commission, a bipartisan commission. Your colleagues, 12 of them, six from the Senate, six from the House, equal representation from both from all the caucuses. And the legislative auditor is appointed for a six-year term. I am currently serving my sixth six-year term as legislative auditor. Before that, by the way, I was the deputy legislative auditor. So I've spent a long time of my career doing this work. The Office of the Legislative Auditor has 60 professionals. We have a financial audit division. Cecile Ferkel is the deputy of that. We also have a program evaluation division, and it also once had a deputy, but I was that deputy. And when we went through budget cuts, the then deputy retired, and I decided that that was one way maybe we would save some money by me going back and filling that position. So currently I serve both as legislative auditor and deputy legislative auditor for the program evaluation division. I'm not sure that that should necessarily continue that way. Sometimes I feel like trying to do both jobs, maybe I don't do them as well as I should, but that is the way it is right now. I think to talk a little bit about our jurisdiction is really important. Again, it'll get somewhat back into the issue of the state auditor versus legislative auditor issue. We have jurisdiction, a responsibility to audit everything in the executive branch, the judicial branch, from the governor's office to the board of nursing. Anything and everything that is in the executive branch, constitutional officers, boards, commissions, departments, agencies, is our responsibility to audit. We also audit in the judicial branch, and we do periodically go and do financial audit work in the judicial branch as well. In addition, we have audit jurisdiction at the University of Minnesota, MNSCU, several metropolitan organizations. We have audit jurisdiction over the Sports Authority that is currently building the new stadium. We have audit jurisdiction over the Metropolitan Airports Commission and the Mosquito Control District. The state auditor, by the way, has audit jurisdiction over the Metropolitan Council. We also have jurisdiction over a number of quasi-governmental organizations, and there are many of them. One of them, for example, would be the Historical Society, which is not a state agency, but it receives a lot of state money, and so we have audit jurisdiction there as well. In fact, if all of that were not enough, we have jurisdiction to basically follow public money into any organization, including private nonprofit organizations, and as I'm sure many of you know, the state gives an enormous amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, to nonprofit organizations to basically carry out state programs, public functions. And we often go into those organizations and trace their use of public money. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, particularly related to the new legacy funds, where a lot of the money is given to nonprofit organizations. So again, just to emphasize on the difference in jurisdiction. So back to 1973, when the Office of the Legislative Auditor was created, and we then had still a state auditor, the decision was made that now the state auditor would become an auditor and would have jurisdiction over local government. So I know many of you are very familiar with local government. Many of you come from local government, so you're quite familiar with the fact that the state auditor is the auditor of local government. I know the names are confusing. State auditor, you would assume, audits the state. Many people assume the legislative auditor audits the legislature. The way to remember it is it's just the reverse. The legislative auditor audits the state auditor audits local units of government. So next time you're at a social event and you talk about, you know, well, gosh, we heard from the legislative auditor, and they say, well, what's the difference between the legislative auditor and the state auditor? You may be the only person in the room that will have the answer to that question. There is one other answer to the question, and that is, you may have noticed that state auditors often go on to greater glory. Arnie Carlson, the current governor, former state auditor, and what you also notice is the legislative auditor, as I said, serving my sixth term, just keeps being legislative auditor. And that is because there is no greater glory than being. I do believe that. So what kinds of work do we do? Well, first, and maybe foremost every year, we audit the state's financial statements. The state of Minnesota, like every other governmental unit now, has to produce financial statements, annual financial statements, that are prepared according to generally accepted accounting principles. And we are the auditor of those financial statements. We just completed that work just a few weeks ago, actually. And we are now doing another part of what we are mandated to do, and that is audit the state's use of federal funds. The state receives lots of federal money. We know that. And the federal government always ties strings to any money they give any other jurisdiction, and one of those strings is that there has to be an independent audit of the use of those federal funds. We are the auditor that fulfills that obligation on the part of the state of Minnesota. After we've done that work, we go periodically back into the state agencies, and I mentioned again, we have jurisdiction and responsibility to audit all of them. We can't obviously audit all of them all at once, and so we very selectively decide every year where are we going to go back in and go in deeper into those organizations and really test and examine their controls and their compliance with the standards, the rules, the laws, all of the requirements, legal requirements, that are put on the money that they receive. Of course, one of the most important things that we want to test is whether or not they're complying with the laws that you have passed. So that's an important part of our work. One of the control compliance audits that we released just recently relates to the new Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, better known as MNsure. Just for your information, we're also going to be releasing an evaluation of MNsure in about mid-February. So in addition to doing control compliance audit work, we also, over the years, have tried to go in and audit the security of computer systems, IT systems. We all know how important that is. The protection of data, the protection particularly of private data, has become just a very heightened concern, not only in the private sector, but in the public sector as well. And it is one of the things that we are really challenged, frankly, right now to do. Because over the years, we have built up a small team of specialists who have the skills and the experience and the knowledge to go in and look at computer security. Unfortunately, those people get to be highly valued, and we just recently, again, for the third time, lost our IT security team. The first time we lost it, they went into the executive branch. Our first IT security audit manager is now the state's chief security officer, Chris Boozy. We rebuilt that team. It got hired away by MNsure, by MNsku. And then our latest one got hired away by the private sector. So we are rebuilding our ability to do that kind of work. As some of you know, particularly those of you who've been in the legislature a number of years, the Office of the Legislative Auditor also does evaluations each year, 6 or 8 evaluations, specifically in response to requests from legislators. So this is the work we do that you ask us to do. It goes through the Legislative Audit Commission, and they make the final selection. Last year, we received 103 requests for evaluations. And so we can never, obviously, do that many. We have staff to do about 6 or 8 a year. But they cover a lot of topics that obviously are of concern and interest to you, and some very specifically to this committee. And you will undoubtedly be having some of the organizations that we've evaluated and audited come before you. And I hope that we can provide you with good information as part, again, of your oversight responsibility. One I might just mention that we completed last year involves what are often referred to as the minority councils, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Black Minnesotans, Chicano Latino people, and Indian Affairs. So it's my understanding that these organizations are part of the account of this committee, and we did find, frankly, lots of issues, lots of problems in the performance of these organizations, and have some recommendations for ways in which we think they should be restructured. So, finally, In addition to all of the work that we do that is scheduled, and I would say most all of the work that I've talked about before is scheduled work. We schedule when we're going to do our financial statement audit work, our control compliance audit work, our computer security work, and our evaluations. But inevitably, the phone rings, I get a letter, one of you may come to my office and say, I have a concern, I've heard allegations, we need somebody to look into them. And often that is the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So in addition to our audit work, our evaluation work, we do have responsibility to investigate allegations, particularly related to the potential misuse of public resources, money, equipment, time, facilities, all those kinds of things. Frankly, we also sometimes are asked to look at an issue just because there needs to be some kind of an outside independent review. It may not be so much finance related. For example, we were recently asked to look at a fairly controversial personnel issue that happened that some of you may be familiar with, and that was the firing of the Mankato football coach. And so legislators were concerned that that he was fired, and then that action was overturned by an arbitrator, and sort of competing positions on who was right. And so we were asked to do kind of a fact-finding on that issue. Currently, another area that we're looking at that we've been requested to look at by legislators that, again, goes a little beyond just financial activity, but some of you are aware that there's quite a bit of controversy about the death of a young man while he was in a drug trial at the University of Minnesota. It happened a number of years ago, but continues to be quite controversial, and we are currently looking at that. So the point here is that there's a wide range of work that we're asked to do. And our goal for all of the work is always the same, whether it's an evaluation, an audit, a special review, an investigation, whatever it is. Our goal is very clear. We are to provide you, legislators, but also agency officials, the public, with accurate, objective, timely, and useful examinations of state agencies and state-funded programs. We also, of course, because we're auditors, we will tell you things that we think are going well, but we're also particularly going to highlight things that are that we think are weaknesses, problems that need correcting, and we make recommendations for improvement. So overall, our goal in all of the work we do is to help ensure the integrity of the state's financial operations.
Auditor Nobles?
Yes.
Excuse me. Would you be willing to
have
questions now?
Anytime, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Noble, thank you for the work you do. And I just kind of, one of the types of examinations that you do in terms of federal funds, could you share what agency or agencies use the most, receives and utilizes the most federal funds?
That would be the Department of Human Services, I would assume, by far. And we are there. In fact, Mr. Chair, members, we actually audit there so frequently for a variety of reasons that we have space there where I have auditors that are basically there, and the folks at DHS see them more than I do. Cecile Furkel may want to comment on that a little bit further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do a lot of work at the Department of Human Services because of the medical assistance program. It's the biggest federal program, and the federal dollars exceed $5 billion. There's a lot, almost a 50% state match on that, too. So we always also look at the corresponding state expenditures. Beyond that, we start looking at DOT, the highway construction programs, special education, using a formula that the federal government provides. We identify a cutoff, a threshold, and any federal program that exceeds that threshold is within the scope of our federal compliance work. For the last few years, the threshold has been $30 million. So that might seem like it would cover a lot of programs. It covers about 25 or 30 programs, but there are hundreds and hundreds of federal programs that don't get examined because they're below that $30 million mark.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Carls?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to your comments about the computer security and the staff turnover. Could you tell us why it seems that there's such a high level of turnover? Is it a lack of competitive salaries, or are they being promoted or having opportunities for better job satisfaction in the other state agencies? And you mentioned one went into the private sector, so I'm just curious as to what's driving that turnover, because we've had reports from you that were pretty vital in terms of computer security, and I would be concerned about that turnover.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's a great concern to us. We feel like we have made a contribution over the years in that area. We want to continue to do that. Over the last several years, I have to say, I think within the executive branch, they have really strengthened their attention on security issues as well. They have to. And that's why they hired away Chris Boozy and our entire team of security auditors to try to make those improvements. Why do people leave? You know, compensation can be a factor. Other opportunities come along, both in agencies and in the private sector. I'd say people with those skills are some of the most highly sought after people. They typically first have a CPA, and then they may have additional certifications. One of the things that we are working on, of course, is trying to upgrade the skills of all of our staff and enable them to look at some of the security issues just as part of a regular financial audit. But we do need that specialized team. It's typically been two, three people, which is quite small. One of the reasons for our budget request, which we'll get to, is to try and expand that team a bit, maybe by another person. But, you know, I would say on compensation, Representative Carlson, we recognize that we will never be able to compete with the private sector in compensation, especially with these highly skilled, highly certified people. They are sought, particularly in the metropolitan area, by some of the biggest financial institutions in the United States. We have the great opportunity here in this metropolitan area to have large banks, insurance companies, and security for them is extremely important, and so our people are very much sought after. I don't know, Cecile, you want to comment any more on turnover?
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Chair, I would just like to comment, kind of reinforce what Jim had said. Our team is so small and so specialized that when we do have turnover in that team, it's really significant. And I think one of the things that we need to work on is creating more redundancy in our skills there. The more people that we have that we can share those skills among, the less of an impact one person leaving has. If we have a team of three and one person leaves, especially if it's a supervisor, we're really hurting. If we have a team of five or six, that one person's exit isn't as significant. So that is one of the strategies that we're hoping that this additional funding will help us with.
I would just add to that, Mr. Chairman, again, back to my point that, I think the state of Minnesota is a good place to work. I think the state of Minnesota pays reasonable salaries and good benefits. But again, we live in an area where many organizations offer more. But the one thing we can offer people, and I do mean this sincerely, is very important, meaningful work. And that is important to people. And that's why Cecile Ferkel is here after all of her years. That's why I'm here after all of mine. We might have, I'm not sure, gone out into the private sector and made more money. But I don't feel like I could have probably ever achieved anything as meaningful and as satisfying and as significant as working on behalf of the people of the state of Minnesota on one of the most important principles of democracy, and that is accountability. I know that sounds grandiose, but it is important, and it is an important thing that we try to instill in the people who come to work there, that you are working on behalf of the people of Minnesota for something that they care about. Whatever party, whatever affiliation, everybody cares about accountability and how their public resources are being spent. And you are going to be front and center in working on that. And so we hope that maybe makes up a little bit for the compensation issue. But as Cecile said, we'll work on the compensation issue some as well.
Mr. Chairman, just for a comment, for a number of years I've been involved with the Minnesota House on personnel issues, and the hardest positions to fill are the IT positions, and the second biggest problem that we also have is the turnover issue. That's why I was particularly interested, not only the importance of the audits that you've done on security, but that's an area that I perked up on at any rate because of our own history here with the Minnesota House. And when we get good people, they're often hired away by other state agencies and or the private sector. And so an issue that you're probably thinking about, and I think we have to think about here as well.
Absolutely. Representative Earhart, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Noble, your recommendations are advisory only, I believe. How often are you not your suggestions not taken?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I have a slide on that, but I'll go ahead and comment on it right now. We make two kinds of recommendations in broad terms. Recommendations to agencies, and in our financial audit division, all of our recommendations are really to the agency. And I would say the vast majority, it's a rare exception that one of our recommendations to an agency is not adopted, because they really have to do with strengthening controls, compliance. So it's pretty black and white. I mean, you're supposed to be doing something, you're not doing it. They at least always pledge that they'll correct whatever the problem is. As some of you know who've been here over time, you know that we also, in our evaluations, make recommendations to the legislature. And we make recommendations to agencies in our evaluations as well. And they often address much more complex, much more controversial issues. And so the record of implementation is mixed, frankly, because some of the recommendations that we make are hard, frankly, politically, to implement. And I would just point to this report, and some of you may be familiar with this. It's a program that some of you may be familiar with, spends a lot of money. It's called the Medical Non-Emergency Transportation Program. And so we made recommendations. We found that this program was really incredibly complex. The organizational structure, the bureaucratic apparatus was just, we thought, really in need of reform. But the reform means there's winners and losers, not only within the bureaucracy, but in the vendor world that provides this service. And so the legislature has set up a number of task forces following up on these recommendations. I know if you want to talk to somebody, I'm not sure if any of you have been on any of those task forces, but I know Representative Barrett has. And if you ever want to talk to somebody about an experience trying to implement recommendations in this area, he can probably give you quite a bit of insight. But there are a lot of other evaluations that I could point to where we have made recommendations that the legislature has taken very seriously, set up a follow-up task force, a working group, but sometimes it takes years. Another one I would refer to is integration revenue. Very controversial program. We thought that the distribution of the money was unfair to many people, many districts. We really had a hard time figuring out what that program was accomplishing. We frankly even had a hard time figuring out what it was supposed to be accomplishing. And so we made a number of recommendations. And over a period of time, again, there were task forces and there were efforts to make reform. Finally, it was Representative Garofalo who said, we're just going to end the program and put language in the law that said until we, you know, we need to figure out, and he sort of put a sunset on it. And so there were finally some changes and reforms, frankly not as far as we would like, but we recognize that some of the recommendations we make are hard to implement because they affect constituencies, they affect interests. And you ultimately represent those interests. And what you decide to do, I think, should be the final word on what change occurs. So we will come to you, tell you where we think things ought to change, and then you will make your efforts to do that. Another one that I think you will struggle with, I will refer back to this report. We do not believe the status quo for these organizations should remain, frankly. We do not think that these organizations are being nearly as effective as they should be. We really question their effectiveness, and we think they need to be restructured. It will be very controversial to do that, and you will experience that. So the best I can do right now is wish you well on that one.
Well, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you did one on the Met Council a year or two ago, and I think that was, there weren't a lot of things implemented out of that, if I remember correctly.
Representative Earhart, I really appreciate you mentioning that one. That's another one that's very near and dear to us. We did an evaluation of the governance of transit in the Twin Cities, and we found that the Metropolitan Council, I think the way we characterized it, does not have credibility, frankly, among many people, especially elected representatives in the Twin Cities, and we really thought that that inhibits the effectiveness of the council, and we thought that the governance structure of the Met Council should be changed and improved. We think it would actually make the council a more effective organization if it had more credibility, and that credibility would come from having at least some elected representatives from local units of government on the council. That recommendation has not been implemented because, again, there are constituencies and interests who will protect the status quo. But again, I would wish you well on that one as well.
Representative Kahn.
I have two issues. One, which we thought we had done last year and was actually removed in an amendment with by accident. This is one, in case you think this is a far left proposal, this is a collaboration with Representative Fabian, who's also interested in it. And that's the question of using legacy for audit of legacy funds, having a section of legacy funding that goes to the auditor so that it doesn't interfere. And thinking that any follow-up you do on an appropriation from legacy ought not be considered supplementing or supplanting. So we would like to do that without specifying, you know, with giving you full freedom to use it, you know, without specifying what should be looked at. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, and I've always appreciated your efforts in these areas. That we're going to talk about that a bit. I'll come to our budget proposal. I think that there are some advantages and, frankly, some disadvantages in that approach, but I do think we need more resources to look at legacy issues, programs, and exactly how you get the resources to us is ultimately going to be up to you. So I'm going to come to our budget issue in just a minute.
And then
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, and then one other issue when you talked about anything funded with state money, several of us are very concerned about the stadium authority and their refusal to use bird safe glass in their massive window, and apparently their major argument against it is that they say that their plan, not the construction, but their plan was done before the state, before the state requirement for the bird safe glass, which is now a requirement in state building codes, was announced. I'd understand it if they had built it, but you know, to say that it was in their plan, particularly since the same company makes both glass. Is there any way we can get the legislative auditor interested in that? Or should it be a state auditor function, or what can
Auditor
we do?
Noble.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
besides
Representative
collecting
Kahn.
The wheelbarrows of birds and depositing them on the Stadium Authority office.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, as I said, we do have audit jurisdiction. I'm not sure that it extends to the issue of bird-safe glass, but I hear your concern.
Well, violation of, Mr. Chairman, violation of the Federal Migratory Bird Act?
Without making a firm commitment, I will just say I have heard your concern and will take it under consideration.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Noble's question for you regarding your information security professionals. Are they CISSPs coming in the door? And for members, that's a certification for IT professionals from an information security perspective. So are they CISSPs before they arrive, or are they getting that certification while they're working for you, and maybe that explains why they're leaving?
I don't know. Or
Mr. Chair and Representative, typically we have... we hire people right out of college. They come in, they get their CPA while they're with us. They get their CISA, their Certified Information Systems Auditor certification, while they're with us. To advance up our career path for IT audit, they need to ultimately get the CISSP, the Certified Information Systems Security Auditor. I'm not sure I got that right.
Professional.
I think that was close. Professional, yes, thank you. So they accumulate these certifications and become more marketable, but it also is very difficult to... The state security environment is quite complex compared to perhaps what an individual business might have. And to bring somebody in from the outside with those credentials, then their challenge is how to work in our really complex environment and adapt to a government setting. It's a trade-off we assess every time we have this opportunity to bring somebody new in. And with a vacancy at our IT audit director level, the highest level, I'm certainly thinking we don't have the luxury to train somebody up through the ranks. We're going to be looking for somebody with these credentials and bring them in at that level.
In fact, Mr. Chairman, I would just add that the one that just left, our manager of IT security, did come from the private sector, from Deloitte, with those certifications. But the competitiveness of the salaries for people who already have that is a problem. Mm-hmm. And so our approach has been to hire out of college, train, but then you have that risk that you very accurately identified.
Chair, follow up.
And I just remind members that Auditor Nobles does have a presentation to come through, and we can have questions at the end, but your follow-up...
Your point well noted, and I will be quiet now.
Representative Nash.
No follow-up? Okay. Mr. Chair, just the follow-up was the average salary. I did a quick search on a tool that I use in my professional life, that the average salary of somebody holding a CISSP is roughly $101,678, and I'm just curious, what is the salary for someone in your area, because I don't have that chapter and verse.
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, our salary was comparative with that, although okay. I know that the person left for a higher compensation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, could you tell me how the extent to which the narrative and the recommendations in the report, does that reflect your personal or your own professional opinion, or is that a staff consensus? How do you come to that recommendation and weaknesses and narrative?
That's an excellent question. I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman and members, we work in a very collaborative way. One of the things I say to people in their orientation session is you will never work alone here. The work of the Office of the Legislative Auditor is the work of all of us together. So what you see in our reports is a collaboration of a team. It may or may not reflect what I would have said. I certainly have a great deal of respect for the people that have done the work. They have the expertise and the experience. I will say, however, that I review every draft. I actively participate. I certainly sign the reports, believing that I will defend them and stand with them. But it is a collaborative effort. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue.
Can you continue?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman. One of the really important things I think you need to know about the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and it goes back to what I started by saying why the office was created, and that is to extend legislative oversight deeper into the bureaucracy, into state agencies. And one of the tools that you gave the Legislative Auditor's Office to do that is that we have statutory access to see all data and documents, regardless of classification. You know, when you do your oversight here, and it's a very important part of legislative oversight, that you call people before you from the Department of Administration or the councils or whomever, and they're going to tell you, I think they're going to tell you the truth, but they're going to tell you what they want you to hear, And frankly, there are some things that they can't tell you because that information is classified as private. And sometimes the information that you really need, the analysis that you need, would require somebody to be able to go in and look at not public data. And we have that authority. And I would say in almost every assignment in our financial audit work and in our evaluation work, we are looking at private, not public documents. Just give you one quick example. We did an evaluation recently of medical services in correctional institutions. There have been deaths, and there's been controversy and concern about the level of service that is provided in correctional institutions, and that has imposed significant liabilities on the state. And so we were asked to look at how well we are treating people in those correctional institutions, and so we obviously had to look at medical records. We had to look at diagnoses, we had to look at follow-up, just to determine whether or not standards, national medical standards, were being met. So, again, throughout the work that we do, whether it's at DHS or wherever we go, we are often using this authority, which is very important. We also, by the way, are subject to the Government Data Practices Act, which means that we have to keep data protected as well. So when we go and look at not public data, we cannot come back and share that with you. We can often develop conclusions and findings in the aggregate based on what we saw in that private data. There is also a very strong statute that requires all government officials to cooperate with the legislative auditor. Also, people in the private sector, nonprofit organizations that receive public money, have to cooperate with our work. If that cooperation is not forthcoming, we do have subpoena power. But as was mentioned, I do have to say that Cecile Furkel has to leave. We actually are going to follow up on one of our reports with Representative Mack, one of our recent reports on MNsure. She wants to have a briefing on that, so Cecile's going to leave. Thank you. But as Representative Earhart mentioned, we cannot require agencies or obviously the legislature to implement our recommendations. So as I already mentioned in response to Representative Earhart's question, our financial audit recommendations are typically not controversial and implementation is generally good. But evaluation recommendations often address complex, controversial issues, and the record there is mixed. So what are the big challenges that we are facing right now? Well, I think we already just talked about one of them, and that is we have a very large area of responsibility and jurisdiction, and it's grown recently with the addition of the four legacy funds, MNsure, and also by added IT security language in our law that gives us that responsibility. We've been doing that work over the years, but the legislature added a section that made that very explicit that that is one of our responsibilities. So that's a big challenge. I already mentioned just the growing increased complexity of generally accepted accounting principles, particularly in the area of pensions. The Government Accounting Standards Board really wants more transparency in government about liabilities, particularly pension liabilities, and keeping up with all of that is a challenge, and staff retention and retirements. So what is our strategy to meet those challenges? Well, we first always start with the goal of using the resources we got. And frankly, we have never come and asked for more. You've, on occasion, given us more, even the last budget session. But this is the first year, and I'm going to get to my budget proposal, that I've come and suggested an additional appropriation beyond the base. But I just want you to know that that's not the first thing we do. Not the first thing we do is come and ask for more. In fact, when we talked about this at the Legislative Audit Commission, and this was an effort by the part of the Legislative Audit Commission to put together this proposal, I said to them, it makes me feel very uncomfortable as legislative auditor being first in line asking for more money. It's just not where an auditor wants to be. So what do we do before we come to you and ask for more? Well, we prioritize, and we try to use our resources strategically.
But what that means is we don't go some places. Now, our strategy in recent years is to say we've got a vast area where we could be going. But what we really want to concentrate on are the core state agencies and state functions. And so that means we have not gone to MNSCU very often. We used to have a very strong presence in auditing MNSCU, the state colleges and universities. We go there now very, very seldom. We also virtually do not go to the University of Minnesota. We used to have a large audit presence at the university. We're currently doing an investigation or a special review that legislators ask for, but we do not do generally financial audit work or evaluation work at the University of Minnesota. We do not go to the Metropolitan Airports Commission. What we have said to some of these organizations is that you can go out and hire a CPA firm to audit your financial statements. You have to get that done. And that's an area where we think firms do a really good job. And so that's where we have said we can pull back. So the Metropolitan Airports Commission goes out, hires a CPA firm, and has their financial statements audited. We retain the responsibility and jurisdiction on an ad hoc basis. We could go there and do additional work. We haven't in many years. We also told the Mosquito Control Commission or district to go hire a CPA firm to audit their financial statements. We retain jurisdiction, could go there if we wanted to, needed to, but we haven't in recent years. Same thing with the Housing Finance Agency and the State Fair. We used to audit the State Fair every year, and we dropped that audit. Again, they are now being covered by a CPA firm. We also actually gave serious consideration to dropping our audit of the state's financial statements. I actually made that proposal a year or two ago, but the Commissioner of Management and Budget was strongly opposed to that. He really felt that that is not a good idea, that we should retain that work. We continue to do an evaluation of whether that is, going forward, the best use of our resources. We do get some benefit out of just doing that work and having an in-depth familiarity with the finances of the state. So anyway, I just, again, want you to know that we do a lot of work, a lot of prioritizing and strategizing before we come to you and talk about any increase in our budget. So let me just very quickly tell you where our money goes. 90% of it is for staff. We are a staff-intensive operation. The way we get our work done is with people, highly trained, skilled, experienced people. We do pay rent. It's my understanding that you had a conversation the other day about how the other legislative offices that occupy this building and the Capitol do not pay rent. We do pay rent. Our offices are in the Centennial Building, so we carry in our budget, have for as long as we've been in that building, an amount of money for rent. We pay $250,000 a year for the space that we occupy in the Centennial Building. We have to keep our staff trained, a certain amount of money in that. We also run big computers to do our work. We have a staff of three that support our computer systems. And then we have a variety of other responsibilities that we have to pay money for. Staffing. We dropped from 80 to 60 people. Back during the big budget crises, I think around 2003, 2004, we took, like everybody, we took very significant budget cuts and laid staff off. So our goal has been since 2003 to just stabilize at 60. And we've been able to generally do that. That's roughly where we are now. Obviously, we, as we've said before, we're constantly having turnover. So today they're not 60 people over at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I looked at the board and I counted, I think there's 57 people currently in those positions, and we'll be recruiting to try to fill the IT security work. But our goal has been at that number, at 60. The Legislative Audit Commission and a number of other legislators have said you probably ought to get a couple more positions. And so our budget proposal would give us funding for 62 positions. We'd probably use at least one, if not both, of those positions in the IT security work. We also are asking for a 4% pool to make salary increases. Now, that is putting that amount of money in our budget. Previously, that money would have come through the LCC. We would have gotten a pool of money for salary increases through the general appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. But again, the Legislative Audit Commission met, said, we would like you, Mr. Nobles, to recommend this budget, this increase in positions by two, and that you would have in your budget a pool for salary increases so that your staff, you know it's there, and you do not have to wait or depend on it being transferred in from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So that is why that is there. I think we've already covered why salary adjustments and compensation is an issue. We have a highly certified and trained and experienced staff, CPAs, CISAs, and in our program evaluation division, everybody, minimum requirement is a master's degree. We also have people with attorney degrees and PhDs. So here is our budget proposal. Now, if you simply appropriated what is in the base, it would be the $6,314,000. And if that is your choice, that's what we will manage. And we will remain, I believe, a strong and effective organization. But again, the proposal that was approved by the Legislative Audit Commission is to increase that by $500,000 a year, which would allow us to hire two additional people and have the performance pool. So, Madam Chair, members, that's our proposal. Be happy to answer additional questions.
Thank you, Auditor Nobles. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, I just want to commend you first and foremost for taking your fiduciary duty so seriously. It's quite refreshing to hear that, you know, a fellow person that takes fiduciary duties such as this. It's an honorable profession, so I thank you for your service to the state. I want to first go back to your slide about authority and just ask you to clarify or to assist me in understanding kind of a legal question. Under that slide, you mentioned that you do have subpoena power.
Yeah.
Which would infer from a legal ramification that you are a clerk of the court. Is that your understanding, Mr. Nobles?
The law reads that we have the same authority as the district court to issue subpoenas, but we cannot enforce the subpoena. We do issue subpoenas on occasion. It's not a general practice. But if we issue a subpoena and it is not complied with, I have to go to district court and ask the court to issue an order of the court, and then a person could be held in contempt of court for not honoring a subpoena. I cannot do that. I issued a subpoena recently to someone who did not honor it, and I decided actually not to go to court. That person lives in another state. It would have been a very complex legal matter to try to bring that person back, and so we did not do that. I would say most people, 99% of people, comply with our request, short of a subpoena, to come into the office. We issue subpoenas. Just give you one example. We were doing an investigation recently. We had reason to believe that there was a nonprofit organization that was misusing public money. The grant had been given to this nonprofit organization by the Department of Health, around $600,000, as I recall. We were doing some examination and looking at documents that we thought did not look right. So the documents were giving the Department of Health justification for reimbursement over several years. And they included bank statements. In other words, somebody says, here's my bank statement with my credit card record that shows that I spent money for a grant purpose. We looked at those documents at the Department of Health and had some question about their authenticity. So we issued a subpoena to the bank and got the original records. And what the original records from the bank showed was that this nonprofit organization had spent that money on purely personal expenses. None of it was spent on the grant purpose. So that's one of the reasons we would issue a subpoena. That person, by the way, just pleaded guilty in federal court.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that leads me to another question. Obviously, with the subpoena power, in your process of discovery for the factual evidence, what would occur in the case, maybe you alluded to it, where it doesn't go to the level of a felony, but it might go to the a point of misconduct, whether that be malfeasance, a breach of trust, or just a misconduct that would be, you know, uncharacteristic or outside the purview of their job description or within the agency. At that point, what does your department have as a tool within your purview that can illuminate, enforce, or bring to others this matter in a manner that could be where reparations or constructive work can be done at that level?
Mr. Chair, members, when we find any misuse of public funds, we start pretty quickly collaborating with appropriate law enforcement. For example, in the investigation that I just referenced, as soon as we thought there was fraud, we were in contact with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, and we worked out an arrangement with them by which we continued our investigation and then turned over our evidence to them, and then the U.S. attorney brought the charges. If it's something less than that, we would potentially be working with a county attorney. We do have an obligation in law, if we find misuse of public resources, to turn over the evidence to an appropriate law enforcement. Usually that would be a county attorney. In some cases, it is the U.S. attorney. We also turn over our evidence to the attorney general, who uses civil action to obtain recovery. We are not a criminal investigative organization. We are a fact-finding organization. And we are very mindful that if there are indications of criminality, that we need to bring in appropriate law enforcement to be aware and potentially even take over the investigation. But we will always retain a concern and an interest and an involvement as to why the fraud or whatever inappropriate activity, how did it occur, why did it occur? And I will just give you one other quick example, which is kind of the reverse of what we did in the case I just cited. We became aware in some of our work at the Department of Revenue some years ago that there was a potential misappropriation of money by an employee of some substantial amount. And so in that case, again, we contacted the U.S. attorney, the FBI, the Department of Treasury, some other people. And in that case, we decided, given the gravity of the situation, that they would proceed ahead of us. And they did. We still retained a concern about how the fraud was perpetuated. How could this senior employee with very broad access to revenue systems perpetrate a fraud of $2 million over a number of years? Now, the U.S. attorney obviously has a primary concern of get this person brought to justice. But our concern is, how did it happen? How did the controls break down? So we needed to come in after the fact, and we did. I hope I'm not going on too much about this.
No, please continue.
Sometimes, you know, what is alleged to us involves misbehavior, bad conduct on the part of an employee, and so we also have to deal with the personnel aspect, and we have to alert the agency, you know, that you may have an employee that is doing something inappropriate, and you, agency, are going to have to deal with that as a personnel matter. Now, maybe you want to deal with it now, maybe you want us to continue with our investigation, but at some point, you've got a personnel action. We cannot take personnel actions, but there may need to be one at some point. And so we just work collaboratively with agencies on at what point are they going to initiate that, and are we going to continue with our work. And again, I could cite you a bunch of examples, but I don't want to go on about this.
I greatly appreciate that information. You want to
just quick.
One short follow-up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Mr. Nobles, when you talked about strategy and the reduction or elimination of audit coverage, I see in your slide that that included MinSCU as well as the University of Minnesota. I'm just wondering what you know of their your knowledge of what they are doing on their own in order to facilitate the audits that you had scheduled or that you were in preparation to complete. How are they facilitating similar accountability on their own? And to the best of your knowledge, is that, are we allowing, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions here, but in some cases, are we allowing the fox to count the chickens?
Excellent point, Mr. Chairman, members. We were willing to back away a bit from both the university and MinSCU because they have very strong internal audit offices. I actually was meeting yesterday with the director of internal audit at the university and have great respect for her and the work that that office does. They also retain outside firms to do audit work, audit their financial statements. MinSCU does as well. So we are willing to pull back some, again, always retaining jurisdiction and authority to go and do what we think needs to be done, where they have a good, strong, internal and independent audit function. The internal auditor at the University of Minnesota and at MinSCU reports to the board, not to management. And so we think that creates a level of independence that, again, we can rely on. And we know their people, we know their credentials, their work. We can often review their work and work collaboratively with them. So, but we would still prefer to go from time to time to a campus of MinSCU and do some more in-depth control compliance work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles.
Thank you
for that excellent presentation.
I really appreciate your interest.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, members. I just want to say to you, thank you for allowing us to go over a little bit of time. I happen to know that taxes was canceled, and so I knew that we had some extra time here to burn. This will not be the last time that Mr. Nobles will be before our committee, unfortunately for him, maybe. But as you can see, he has a wealth of knowledge of the process, and I encourage you, if you have more questions, to visit with him after committee or set a time that fits your schedule better, too. So I know that he'd be more than willing to do that. I just want to give you an update for Tuesday's committee hearing. Unfortunately, we're going to be back to the 8:15 time schedule. I know the 9 was really nice this morning. But we are going to be taking a tour of the Capitol at 8:15 on Tuesday. So I would encourage you strongly to wear sensible shoes. And if you need an excuse to wear jeans on that day, by all means, you know, I think we're going to be going through some construction things, so be practical, too, about the clothing that you wear so that it doesn't get damaged throughout our tour. So we'll be wearing hard hats and all that good stuff. So it should be exciting to see the progress that they're making on the renovations, and look forward to seeing you at 8:15 on Tuesday with good walking shoes on, okay? And are there any questions to that, or excuse me, Mr. Chair? Oh, yes. And then also, we are going to start off the tour here. I just thought it would be easier. We all know where this is. And then we will split up into two different groups, and we'll go from there. Okay?
Any further questions? Well, then I bring this meeting of the State Government Finance adjourned.